blind, have low vision, or have another print disability which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Mary Beth, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the Sunday, November 1st, 2025, issue of Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The Smart Way to Rethink Tech Pants by Ashley Ogawa Clark. If you work in a casual office, you've probably seen them. You may own a pair. Like the devil, they go by many names: tech, athleisure, golf, or performance pants. Typically snap-buttoned, flat-fronted, and cut slim, they come in safe shades like chino, beige, gray, and navy. All the athleisure brands sell them. Tech pants offer the comfort of track pants, thanks to stretchy, mostly synthetic fabrics, usually a mix of polyester and elastane. When viewed from a distance and with considerable squinting, they almost look sharp. In the era of relaxed corporate dress codes and athleisure everything, tech pants have become an it item for regular guys for work and play. Andrew Weitz, founder of Beverly Hills Style Consultancy, The Weitz Effect, put it this way: no matter whether you're the assistant, the CEO, or Joe Schmo, you're wearing tech pants. Turner Allen, a personal stylist in New York who works with tech guys, concurs. Most of my clients have some version of the ABC pant, he said, referring to Lululemon's famously comfy model. ABC stands for anti-ball crushing. Lululemon says the $138 pants, made from polyester blends with nerdy-sounding names like Elastomultister and Warpstream, are among the brand's top-selling lines. Popular alternatives include Vuari's $128 Meta model and Rhone's $138 commuter pant. Costco's Kirkland Signature brand offers sub-$50 performance pants with four-way stretch. The problem? Lots of people despise tech pants as uncool and artificial-looking, evidence that the athleisure trend has gone too far. In July, GQ declared, "We must end the scourge of tech pants." Attached to your tech pants and unwilling to retire them? On the hunt for an upgraded pair? No idea what tech pants were until now? Read on for answers to burning questions about these stretchy specimens, including styling tips to make them presentable and strategies to avoid looking like you're dressed for a fencing match. 1. Why do so many men love these pants? Beyond praising their comfort, fans consider them unfussy and just sharp enough for many offices today. They don't wrinkle, stain, or fade in the wash, and I don't need to have them dry cleaned, said Fred Cibelli, a principal at EY in New York who has worn tech pants since a friend recommended them during the pandemic. He owns them in navy, black, gray, and, for the summer, cream. What more do you need? said the 48-year-old. Cibelli, a technology consultant focused on financial services, has no issues wearing tech pants to the office, even when meeting with clients. In my circles in New York, I don't see much of a backlash, he said, though he admitted he wouldn't wear them if he were a banker. Other guys save them for outside the office. Jason Hodes, a 50-year-old who works in the entertainment industry in New York, wears his Roan pants to golf and travel. They're what I'll wear to replace a sweatpant, he said. 2, all that sounds pretty good, so why the hate? That GQ article called tech pants a damning symptom of our society's obsession with putting comfort and efficiency above all else. Other critics say that tech pants look weirdly smooth and shiny, and at their worst, like cheap, highly flammable leggings. Men love them and want to live in them, but I can tell you that their partners, both business and personal, have gotten sick of them, said Weitz. Guys who care about the way they present themselves want to move on from these pants. Eugene Park, a 35-year-old marketing manager in Costa Mesa, California, used to own tech pants in multiple colors, but in the past year he has replaced them with what he calls real pants, trousers made from wool or cotton. Once you get more into fashion, you realize there are other good options out there, he said. Number three, so should I throw all my tech pants into a bonfire? No, the chemical fumes will choke you. In all seriousness, if you love your tech pants, you can hold on to them. I don't think these pants are horrible to the point where I need to completely eliminate them from a client's closet, said Alan, speaking with the deadpan conviction of a pest exterminator. For him, the issue is when men begin to wear them in a very formal context. Avoid pairing them with a blazer and tie, and don't even think about wearing them to the wedding of anyone you consider a friend. Number four, are any types of tech pants especially bad? What should I avoid? Whites recommends sticking to straight leg versions. Absolutely no skinny cuts unless you plan to make leggings part of your office uniform. Park is wary of tapered cuts. Since they narrow at the calves and ankles, it looks like you're wearing clown shoes. Check the fabric composition on tags before you buy. Alan recommends designs with only a small amount of elastane, say 2%, so you get a bit of stretch, but not that athletic sheen. Travis Repkamp, founder of Archer, a brand making elevated performance pants from Merino Blends, experimented with a number of fabrics before landing on his recipe. In his experience, when pants contain more than 3% elastane, they become clingy, bunch up, and look sloppy. A high percentage of polyester, he said, can lead to a synthetic shine. Number five, can you recommend any sharp tech pants? Sure. Archer's $298 Tropical Performance Trouser, TPT, is made from merino wool spiked with 1.5% Royica V550 and eco-friendly stretch yarn. That makes them breathable and a little stretchy, suitable for the golf course, but also for even the strictest offices. I didn't want them to look at all like a tech pant, said Redkamp, who sought to make elevated trousers you'd still be able to squat in. Hodes, the entertainment industry worker, owns a few pairs of TPTs. He finds them dressier and much more classic than regular tech pants. Other brands that should be on your radar, J. Hilburn, which offers custom-made wool elastane pants for around $370. Nothing Something, maker of sharp, streamlined designs in black crepe, and Literary Sport, a cool sports label that sells suave black track pants and other loungeabout designs. Check out its Austin model. Alan gets his tech pant-loving clients into slightly stretchy chinos. He likes the standard pleated chino from Alex Mill, 98% cotton with 2% elastane. With subtle pleats, they're an approachable option, he says. Number six, I own a bunch of tech pants. How should I style them? You can make them look cool, said Whites. Keep the rest of the outfit relatively casual, he suggests. Attempts to smarten up these pants with a sport coat won't fool anyone. One neat option. Channel a Starship Enterprise commander and go uber minimal in head-to-toe dark shades. For the office, Shabelli wears black or navy tech pants with matching simple long-sleeve crewnecks from Theory and Saturday's NYC. It's clean and it's crisp, he said. Another fail-safe option for chill offices, a classic pinstripe shirt, a waffle knit or ribbed crewneck sweater, and loafers. The sweater adds texture, which saves the outfit from reading eerily smooth, while the loafers stop it from registering as overly athleisurely. 7. I'm ready to ditch sporty pants and move on to real pants. What are some great comfy options for a casual office? If you're doing away with stretch, Alan would go for pants with a relaxed fit that won't suffocate, such as the Hoke style by Officine Generale, available in fabrics such as 100% virgin wool. He praised its clean, tapered silhouette from the knee down. For a more voluminous, insouciant look, he called for the Justin, a $340 drapey dress pant from NN.07 with an easy-to-adjust black back waist buckle. Park, who ended up selling his tech pants to his local Crossroads, has landed on a handful of cool alternatives. In casual settings, he favors M43 cargo pants, a baggy style he picks up at flea markets or on eBay. Slightly sharper are his army fatigues from RRL and Japan's Orslo, which come in shades of green and khaki and are cut from robust cotton that softens over time. He finds them as comfy as tech pants. Their wider cut gives his legs room to breathe and much easier to style. They just look better. The Sample Life. It's sample sale season. Cue the Professional Line Standards by Sophia Eyre Herring. At 8 a.m. on a late October Wednesday, a line stretched down four New York City blocks from the Metropolitan Pavilion on West 18th Street. It was 2 hours before the Row's annual sale opened to the public. The first 85 people outside the event, hosted by the third-party company Privé, had been waiting since at least midnight, some as early as 6 p.m. the previous day. Most people marking time in the line did not look like devotees of the Row's luxury goods. Founded by Mary Kate and Ashley Olson, the brand is known for its minimalist aesthetic and sky-high prices. $4,900 leather totes and $1,450 cashmere sweaters. But here were a few dozen middle-aged men dressed in outdoor gear and decked out with tents and tarps. No, these men had not come to shop. They were professional line standers, secured by shoppers as far ahead as months in advance on apps such as TaskRabbit or through line standing services such as New York-based Same Old Line Dudes. Some were being paid as much as $800 for the job. And no wonder. Sample sales, once meant to offer access to all, have become highly competitive as luxury prices have skyrocketed, with shoppers willing to spend big just to get inside, where discounts can be as steep as 90%. "This is our Super Bowl," said Robert Samuel, owner and founder of Same Old Line Dudes. He said fall was the busiest season for sample sales, with brands like Jimmy Choo, Vince and Prada hosting events. In response to demand for the Row sale, which ran from October 22nd to October 24th, Samuel doubled his usual 35-person staff for the week. He said that 61 of the first 80 spots in the Row's line on opening day had been his employees, each paid $25 an hour by his clients. The Row did not respond to a request for comment. The week prior, Samuel replaced his phone line with an automated message. Quote, "We are currently booked out for the Row through Wednesday with limited managers available to answer requests," end quote. "It's the longest sample sale line I've seen, but it's not out of hand," said James Prater, a line stander for the past 26 years, packing up the tarp he used to stay dry from the rain showers throughout the evening. A few spots down, Prater's colleagues, Michael Jordan, 32, and Halil Hunt, 34, passed the time in a tent stocked with a TV and PlayStation portable. It was Hunt's first night on the job. "There's a lot of camaraderie here," said Hunt. "People recognize each other from past events. Say what's up." Owen Jin, who co-founded the sample sale platform Cheech Me in 2015, said the sales have become more popular in the last decade. "Back when I started in 2015, it was such a private industry. A lot of brands just did friends and family. Now," she said, "it's reached a new level in the industry that nobody expected." Jin credits the rise largely to platforms such as TikTok, where users post haul videos showing off what they bought and trying clothes on for followers. Others, such as Haley Corwick, a fashion blogger who goes by at Madison Avenue Spy on Instagram, post teaser videos tipping followers off to sample sales. Thanks to Corwick's fashion connections, she often attends the Friends and Family Day, an invite-only event before the sale officially opens. Because this day draws shorter lines, she doesn't use a line stander. But doing so doesn't seem outrageous to her, since shoppers save money when they buy from the sale instead of paying full retail prices at the Row's stores. "It's luxury logic. You're paying for access to pay less," she said. Corwick spent $2,150 on items that originally totaled $6,940, according to her receipt. Even if she paid for a sitter for 10 hours at $25 an hour, she would have saved thousands. When a video posted to Instagram and TikTok on the day the Row sale opened to the public captured the tents stretched across the sidewalk, it got over 97,000 views and a slew of negative comments. "Looks like a homeless encampment," said one commenter. The next day, a sign was posted in front of the building that read, "Notice, no chairs or tents are allowed on the sidewalk." Both the backlash on social media and the icy atmosphere the event staffers created were hard to swallow, said Samuel. I understand that given the level of luxury with the brand, having tents outside the venue is jarring, he said. But ultimately, we're hired to help with the mission, and sometimes it's not always going to look as neatly packaged as you'd like. On Friday, October 24th, Privé sent out a notice that, due to an inventory shortage, the Rose sale would be closing one day early. Ariel Kaminsky, 27, got the idea to hire a line stander from social media. I didn't even know line standers existed until TikTok, she said. After failing to book same old line dudes, Kaminsky went to TaskRabbit and hired someone to wait from midnight to 9:30 a.m. for $335. I thought I would be the first in line because who else is going to get a line stander to show up the night before? But this guy had to go around the block. Kaminsky was happy with her purchases, which included four pairs of shoes and a bag full of clothing. Though satisfied with her stander, she felt conflicted about using one to shop for luxury clothes at all. You look at yourself in the mirror and think, why am I doing this? You are listening to a reading of articles and features from Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Where the West is still wild, the corner of Georgia, the country that is, proves you can still have a European vacation sans crowds. By Caroline Eden. Did you hear that howling last night? It sounds like wolves, I asked. Jackals, said my road trip partner Megan, an American who calls Tbilisi, the capital of Georgia, home. We both took another bite of our homemade chapadpuri, the glorious cheesy bread that's now trending well beyond Georgia's borders. Morning mist swirled around the emerald green hills through which we'd hiked the previous day. It looked like rain, we agreed. Apart from one other couple, we were the sole visitors in this 150-year-old guest house near Makahiklala National Park. As much of Europe buckles under the weight of mass tourism, Georgia is only now getting in on the action in earnest. Most vacationers follow a well-trodden circuit, churches, wine, mountains, that includes Tbilisi, the winelands of Kakheti, and the mountainous Gazbiji region. But the country's far west remains delightfully off-grid, a place for those seeking a different, quieter Europe. Before we'd driven an hour to get to Makahela Park, National Park, Megan and I had spent several days exploring Batumi, Georgia's second city and the capital of the Ajara region. There, on the shores of the Black Sea, we'd stayed at the latest iteration of the stylish rooms chain, where our quarters resembled a chic ship's cabin, complete with bunk beds. As we hopped between the wine bar, where DJs spun, and the rooftop pool with splendid views of the port, we saw few other guests. In downtown Batumi, which has undergone a bit of a facelift in recent years, we found no signs of the tourist crowds that can mob to Tbilisi. Whenever I return to Batumi, which I've done five times, I always do three things. I stroll along the palm-fringed seaside esplanade, admiring the gardens first landscaped in 1881. Then I order a dish of Black Sea mussels in blue cheese sauce at Fan Fan, housed in a 120-year-old building that the famous Georgian writer Chabua Amerijebi once owned. In the afternoon, I take a 15-minute cab ride to Batumi's Botanical Garden. Overlooking the sea and spread over 270 acres, it was one of the largest such gardens in the Soviet Union. No surprise, given the proverb that the region's fecundity inspired, quote, "a man only has to spit on the ground for an orange to grow," end quote. Trails lead past old-fashioned greenhouses, beehives, and eucalyptus, palm, and cork trees. Megan, I learned, had never experienced the scenic, hair-raising cable car ride that connects the small mountain town of Kulo with the tiny village of Tago. But we found the single red pod, big enough for six adults, closed for maintenance. I feigned disappointment, but secretly sighed with relief. The last time I'd come, the pod's door hadn't closed, spiking my adrenaline even more during the 7-minute trip across the valley. Luckily, I had another suggestion, a visit to the brightly painted wooden mosques that dot the Adjara Hills. They persist in this largely Christian country because Adjara, directly neighboring Turkey, was part of the Ottoman Empire until 1878. To reach Gorjomi Mosque, one of the biggest, we drove up hairpin mountain lanes edged with blue hydrangeas until we spotted the minaret. Then, covering our hair, we stepped inside and across perfectly hoovered crimson carpets under chandeliers. We admired the minbar pulpit, almost psychedelic in its swirling colors. Megan's odd expressions clearly demonstrated that as much as you know a place, you can always find more to amaze you. Spend enough time exploring Adjara and you might, as I did on a separate recent trip, eventually spill over into the neighboring region of Guria. When you're just another tourist following a well-trodden itinerary, serendipity is rare, but the Georgian hinterland seems to regularly yield chance happenings. I was standing admiring Shemekmedi Monastery high above the Bizhuzi River when seemingly out of nowhere, a priest appeared. Before joining the monastery 19 years ago, he told me, he worked as a sailor on Black Sea merchant ships. During Soviet times, when the church was closed, people would mark their visit by running their thumbs across the outside wall. That's what those black lines are, he said. I marveled at how those marks of piety remained, just an hour away from the room's hotel's sleek pool deck. From the monastery, I followed signs for the tea route, a fledgling agro-tourism initiative, and eventually reached Komli, where Lika Megrelazadze lives and grows tea. After 35 years in Tbilisi, Megrelazadze had returned to Guria, where, along with plucking tea leaves, she also makes wine and hosts the odd guest. She considers herself more of an educator than a producer, she explained. I only roll a little tea, mainly to show how it's done. After lunch, we put on traditional tea pickers' hats and walk down to the bushes. The only sound was the trickle of a nearby stream. Ever want to bring that hotel pillow home? Often you can, but you must pay for it. And tracking it down can be surprisingly complicated. Why are the beds at hotels so much more comfortable than the rumpled, lumpy things we settle for at home? Is it the firmness of the mattress, the tautness of the sheets? For me, it's usually about the pillows. The first night at a new hotel involves Goldilocks-like antics as I sample each of the varieties piled on my bed. No to the rock-hard neckbreaker, no to the silly little square cushions I call chiclets. Most of the time, I find one that does the job handily, but on a recent trip, I sighed with happiness when my head hit my chosen pillow. Awakening the next morning at the Post Oak Hotel in Houston, I knew I had to have it. I snapped a picture of the pillow's label and checked out. Turns out, tracking down hotel pillows can be far more complicated than a quick web search. I knew from my sleuthing that a company named Sobel Westex made the pillow, but as I scoured its website, I realized it made 6 lines of pillows and I didn't know which Post Oak stocked. When I contacted the hotel, confusion intensified. The Post Oak was in the midst of a, quote-unquote, pillow transition. The assistant director of housekeeping explained apologetically, something luxury hotels do roughly every 2 years. So she wasn't immediately sure which pillow I'd experienced. Finally, by cross-referencing my room type and date of stay, she identified my holy grail as the Hotel Bellajour Duo Down Soft Feather Pillow, which I promptly ordered online for $95. I was lucky, it seems, to have satisfied my quest with a phone call. As Walter Pilaz, CEO of Sobel Westex, explained, the company designs many, many pillows exclusively for hotels and only offers them directly to consumers if they become popular, after, say, reports come in that guests have been badgering housekeeping departments about them. Clearly, I hadn't been the first to gush about the Post Oak's pillow. Stephen Chow, general manager of Post Oak Hotel, said that due to popular demand, the hotel will soon join an increasing number of luxury hotels that sell their bedding at on-site boutiques. At certain Fairmont locations in Canada, for example, you can buy Fairmont-branded pillows made by Northern Feather at property boutiques for around $135. Fairmont fans at other locations can still buy the same pillows on the online Fairmont store or Northern Feathers website. Ritz-Carlton, which is owned by Marriott International, sells its own proprietary line of pillows online too. At the Ritz-Carlton Rentals, Lake Oconee in Greensboro, Georgia, you sleep on the feather and down chamber pillow labeled with the Ritz-Carlton name. Want to take it home? You have no option but to head to the Marriott Bonvoy Boutique's website and pay $165. No matter how hard I tried, I couldn't get anyone to divulge who actually makes the pillows. Thankfully, you needn't undertake the same wild goose down chases I did to replicate a hotel night's sleep. If you can't find the exact pillow you love, take note of the materials listed on the label. Blaze says hotel quality pillows tend to include a high quality fill inside a thickly woven cotton casing called ticking. For the fill, the best hotels opt for hypoallergenic down with medium firmness. Find such a pillow to sleep on at home and you might reflexively reach for a phone call to room service in the morning. The article was by Rebecca Durline. Hate giant airports? You can get help navigating them if you're willing to pay. By Barbara Peterson. The process of getting to your flight can seem daunting in the age of the mega airport. From bag check to security to the serpentine concourses filled with high-end shops, private airline clubs, restaurants, spas, and more, making your way through a supervised airport terminal is like a journey in itself. And it can be especially overwhelming if you're on a tight schedule or traveling with young children and older family members. In addition to being time-consuming and often stressful, the long trip from curb to departure gate isn't something all flyers are physically prepared to handle. And it isn't just those with mobility issues. Some travelers just have difficulty trekking through long airport corridors with their gear. We're all aging while our airports are getting bigger, says Ty Osbaugh, principal architect at Gensler, the architectural firm behind dozens of new airport terminals, including one that opened in September at San Diego International Airport. To help flyers navigate these behemoths, our airlines and airports have added improved signage, interactive maps, and digital displays showing estimated walking times to departure gates. They've also updated their apps with better maps and flight information. But as airports around the world become ever larger and more complex, interest is growing in more personalized assistance programs that promise a less painful airport experience for travelers who are willing to pay. Offered by airlines and other companies for a fee, these services may include perks like personal concierges, assistance with luggage, expedited security access, access to VIP lounges, and more. And in many cases, you don't have to be a first-class passenger, frequent flyer, or premium credit card holder to book them. Paul Tompofsky, Chief Revenue Officer of Fora Travel, a travel agency, says he almost always recommends that his clients use some sort of airport assistance service. It can be pricey, depending on the services you would choose, but it is usually worth it. He says, coming off a crowded plane at a strange airport, nothing beats seeing someone holding a sign with your name on it, he says. Here is a closer look at some of the services. Airline add-ons. At least three major U.S. airlines, Delta, United, and American, and Air France and British Airways, are among the carriers that offer premium hand-holding services for passengers at key airports. Delta VIP Select program is available in 11 domestic hubs, including New York, LaGuardia and JFK, Los Angeles, Atlanta, and Minneapolis. It includes a guide to take you through the airport, help with check-in and baggage, complimentary access to Sky Club lounges, and in some locations, a private car to take you straight to the plane. Prices start at $550 for the first passenger and $100 for each additional flyer per trip. United passengers can get VIP treatment at the airport through the Signature Service Program, available at 21 airports in the U.S. and abroad. A greeter will meet you at the curb, accompany you through security, and get you inside the airplane's club starting at around $250 per person. Air France offers a range of concierge services at Paris Charles de Gaulle for prices starting at $350 a person. British Airways offers its flyers access to an airport concierge through a partnership with Diamond Air. It can be particularly useful for travelers flying in and out of airlines based at Heathrow Airport, which has the most flight connections of any airport in the world. The service will send someone to meet you upon arrival, escort you through immigration and customs, and take you to your connecting flight. Prices vary. American Airlines' five-star service program, meanwhile, is available only to passengers traveling in business or first class. It is offered at 22 U.S. and international airports, including New York, Los Angeles, London, and Tokyo, for $350 for the first person, $100 per additional adult, and $50 per child. Of course, for flyers whose main concern is mobility, airlines operating in the U.S. are required to provide transportation to and from gates via wheelchair, yet no additional charge for those who need it. Airlines suggest you request wheelchair assistance when you book your flight or up to 48 hours before departure. Concierge companies. Travelers who want a personal airport guide also can work with separate concierge companies, some of which have contracts with big airports worldwide. The airport Sherpas will help you avoid lines at check-in, escort you to a fast-track security lane, get you into a VIP lounge, and take you to your gate. If you're arriving from abroad, they can meet you at your arrival gate and help you through customs. In some places, this service could include transfers by limo directly to the waiting aircraft. Providers include the Queen of Clubs, offered by a boutique luxury travel company in several European countries, including the UK and France, as well as larger networks such as Parc Soleil and Royal Airport Concierge, which are in hundreds of airports worldwide. Prices vary. A meet and greet or a transfer service at major international gateways in Europe and Asia could range from $250 to more than $500 a person. A newer arrival in this business is Clear Concierge, a new service from Clear, the ID security firm that speeds flyers through security checkpoints faster by verifying their identity for an annual fee. The company is now offering Clear members a personal escort who will take them from curb through security for $99 to a wider array of services that will get them all the way to the departure gate for $179. It's being rolled out at 23 major U.S. airports, including Denver International, Orlando, and Salt Lake City. Luxury offerings. For a true splurge, a small number of clubs offer passengers flying commercial a whiff of the private jet lifestyle, bypassing the hated airport experience altogether. In the U.S., the PS brand for private suite offers flyers a sanctuary in the form of a separate terminal away from the main airport. There, travelers get full lounge amenities and can check their luggage, get a boarding pass, and clear security and customs privately. Michael Holtz, CEO of travel firm Smart Flyer, who uses the service often, says a private car service takes passengers to and from the lounge and the plane, which they board or disembark from via the jetway stairs. PS is available in Los Angeles and Atlanta and plans to add locations in Miami, Dallas, and Paris. Prices start at around $1,200 plus per person. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Italy's Puglia region is a pasta lover's dream by J.S. Marcus. Pasta is an Italian national staple, but it plays a special role in Puglia, the heel of the country's boot. The region is Italy's breadbasket, typically producing more durum wheat than any other part of the country, and locals often eat pasta twice a day. It's also home to pasta producers as diverse as Granoro, one of Italy's most popular supermarket brands, and Pastificio Benedetto Cavalieri, a top-notch artisanal maker. Even Monograno Felicetti, an artisanal brand based in a valley in the Alps, touts that it uses durum wheat from Puglia in some of its products. A visit to Puglia is an education in the Italian maxim that when it comes to pasta, shape is taste, says Fabio Amadei, head of the food studies department at ALMA, the School of Italian Culinary Arts near Parma. Ear-shaped orecchiette, Puglia's best-known regional specialty, is often paired with broccoli rabe or a basic tomato sauce. With flappy stracciatella goes with meat-rich, long-simmered sauces. Maritati, which marries a few contrasting but similar smaller shapes, might get paired with small meatballs about the same size. And bite-sized, bean-shaped cavatelli goes well with shellfish. In recent years, Puglia has started to export its culinary heritage. Burrata, anyone? But many of the region's specialties are still best sampled in situ. Orecchiette secret. I started my tour of Puglia's pasta dishes in the coastal city of Bari, Puglia's capital and lone metropolis. With its Bronze Age origins, ancient Roman traces, Byzantine and Norman monuments, and subtropical flair, Bari makes for a fine contrast with the Renaissance grandeur and contemporary design of central and northern Italian towns. Bari Vecchia, or Old Bari, is a dizzying but inviting warren of white stone alleyways and sunny piazzas that make up the historic heart of the city. The neighborhood has a winding lane devoted to pasta called Arcobasso, also known as Orecchiette Street. What starts out as an open-air market of freshly made wares is now something of a tourist trap, but my first run-in with the made-to-order orecchiette con le concime di rapa, orecchiette with broccoli rabe, at an informal nearby restaurant called Cala Tin Puglia was a revelation. The broccoli rabe was turned into a kind of cruciferous pesto. Orecchiette's secret is that one side is rough and the other side is smooth, says Amade, and these opposing surfaces make it ideal for mixing with its specific range of sauces, which can cling to but not overwhelm the noodles. Thanks to a key bit of bitterness from fresh olive oil, another Puglia's specialty, and the still pungent greens, the combination with a rather meaty pasta shape was both subtle and hearty. My Airbnb host told me about Pastificio Ancora, a small artisanal shop that sells fresh pasta, where I leapt at the chance to buy orecchiette made with a kind of burnt wheat called grano arso, a Puglisi oddity rooted in poverty and now a sign of culinary refinement. After harvesting, Puglia's wheat farmers would burn their naked stalks to clear the fields. The process left half-burnt kernels on the ground, which were gathered by the poorest of the poor and used to make a coarse pasta dough. Now, a small percentage of dark roasted grain is combined with regular durum wheat to create a nutty and chewy pasta that only needs pairing with the simplest of homemade tomato sauces. I whipped up some orecchiette al pomodoro using grano arso pasta, the color of concrete, in my guest apartment in under 20 minutes. Puglia's immense coastline, the longest of any region of mainland Italy, is one of the building blocks of the Puglia's culinary prowess, along with its fertile hinterland. These maritime and rustic resources are reflected in local pasta combinations. A typical everyday pasta dish here is cavatelli with mussels. The region also is home to one of the country's recent pasta innovations, spaghetti all'assassina, or murderer style, invented in Bari in the 1960s. An unlikely, spicy, crunching retooling of spaghetti with chili spiked tomato sauce. It requires cooking the pasta and the sauce in the same pan to the point of charring. At Urban, a Bari restaurant that specializes in many variations of spaghetti all'assassina, the waiter suggested I top mine with creamy shreds of mozzarella like stracciatella cheese, a reminder that burrata was invented near here. Pasta has been eaten in southern Italy since the Middle Ages, when Sicily's Arab overseers introduced the drying of dough as a form of preservation, according to Amade. The long, thin spaghetti shape, he says, was an especially efficient way to dry the pasta by hanging the strands on structures similar to clotheslines. But it wasn't until the post-World War II era when Granora and other industrial giants started mass-producing and marketing a variety of pastas that a vast number of shapes were widely diffused across Italy and the world. Granora, it turns out, is based in the town of Carrara, Corrado, a commuter train ride away from Bari, and the company offers tours by appointment. Founded in 1967, it produces over 150 kinds of pasta, and the fully automated factory floor, staffed with about 70 people, can bag 400 tons a day. I marveled at the endless procession of uncut pasta sheets flowing down and around the machinery, which seemed to be turning out tents rather than food. Up the coast in Barletta, a city of just under 100,000, I doubled up on pasta at Baco, a Michelin-recommended restaurant, by having a half portion of spaghetti with sea urchin, a local delicacy, as an appetizer, and then a portion of stracinatati al ragù di cavallo. Yes, cavallo means horse meat, as a main course. Stracinati is, as the name in Italian suggests, is a type of pasta dragged into shape, typically ending up as a medallion like discs. Classically paired with long simmered meat-rich sauces, they blend better with a complex ragu, says Bacco's chef, Ruggiero Doronzo, a Barletto native. The horse ragu was surprisingly delicious, tender and rich. Trani, between Barletta and Bari, is known as the most beautiful town in this part of Puglia, thanks to the local white limestone marked by a tad of pink. Its 12th century cathedral with a 13th century bell tower is built right on the water. On a clear hot day, I made my way to Lab 57, a local eatery known for its pasta dishes. On standard Italian menus, pasta is known as a first course in what amounts to a second appetizer. Here, where there is no regular menu, pasta is simply and emphatically the main event. I chose dried spaghettoni, or thick spaghetti, that the chef combined with a thick, dark, and sublime octopus ragu. Of all the historical monuments in Puglia, it is the inland landmark of Castel di Monte, a hilltop octagonal castle that has become a national symbol, finding its way into stamps and money. When I visited, I could see why. Its urgent grandeur made Europe's Middle Ages seem like yesterday. The view down and around was an expanse of Puglia's timeless countryside, marked by olive groves and vineyards, and in the distance, its celebrated wheat fields. I couldn't help but think that another fitting symbol for Italy would be a stalk of Pugliese wheat. Caviar on everything and other annoying restaurant trends. We asked industry pros what trends had been overdone or should never have started in the first place. They had plenty to say. If you dine out these days, you'll find a lot of trends on the menu. Between omakase, small plates, and cocktails with unpronounceable ingredients, even the most devoted foodies can get baffled when they walk into a restaurant. And don't forget the decorations for selfies or the water served in tiny bottles. It's so excessively over the top that it dilutes the entire reason for being there, says Omar Popal, co-founder of Popal Restaurant Group in Washington, D.C. So, which fads would the pros cross off the menu? We ask some experts to share the trends they find the most annoying. 1. Caviar on everything. Restaurants are using caviar to create odd food combos and elevate unexpected dishes, adding the fish eggs to everything from cheesecake to chicken nuggets and hot dogs. But just dropping caviar into a dish doesn't guarantee that it tastes better, says Leith Steele, a restaurant consultant at Care Bounty, a hospitality agency in Cincinnati. It has a fairly subtle flavor, and it makes absolutely no sense to me to put it on a hamburger, she says. Next, inadequate carafes. Originally made in the 1800s for carrying beer, glass bottles with stoppers are popular thanks to their classic design, but they just aren't practical, says Evan Hennessy, chef owner of Stages at One Washington in Dover, New Hampshire. The swing top bottles look great, but they hold only 2 cups of water apiece, and that means constant refills. It looks good on a picture, and that's about it, Hennessy says, adding that in his own restaurant, he uses larger carafes to smooth out service and keep diners from getting grumpy. Another waiter gripe, restaurants purposely not offering tap water can feel exclusionary, says Alexius Milos, a marketing executive at Dynamique, a Chicago-based restaurant group. Many diners don't want to be given the choice of sparkling or still without the option of drinking tap, he says. Next, walls to make a statement. Big displays with neon signs, selfie mirrors, and even swings or old Vespas are an annoying part of today's restaurant scene, says Popal. They can be a logistical hassle. As diners gather for photos, other people are forced to maneuver around them. And does the restaurant care more about the decor than the food? Another complaint, time limits for dining. During COVID, many restaurants started enforcing time limits for taking up a table, and some never stopped. But these days, telling a table for two that they only have 90 minutes to eat is unappetizing, says Benjamin Berg, founder of the Berg Restaurant Group in Houston. It seems very transactional to me, and you start losing the whole hospitality thing, he says. And since the pace of service can depend on the restaurant's staffing that evening, slower service forces guests to rush and finish their food, he says. At his restaurants, the staff may use subtle signs, such as turning up the music or bringing dessert menus to entice diners to leave earlier, especially at peak dinner times around 7 p.m. But if you're reminding me at the host stand about the time limit, do you even really want me here? He says. Another, flowers you can eat. Chefs often use tiny flowers and microgreens to make plates pop, but they may end up confusing diners, said Alejandro Espinosa, owner and executive chef of Cotoa in Miami. Though the flowers are edible, most people push them off their plates because they aren't sure. Diners are more willing to eat microgreens but avoid them because they aren't sure about the taste. Meanwhile, both types of delicate greens are expensive and impractical because they spoil after 2 days. Every chef is fighting for them, and they don't last very long, said Espinosa, who prefers using cilantro and other vibrantly colored greens to impart similar flavors. Another annoying trend, long scripted intros. It is tiresome to hear servers deliver endless pre-planned patter, says Milolis. Minutes-long monologues about the menu, specials, and styles of the restaurant come across as robotic and alienate frequent diners or those who have already done their homework, he says. Shorter intros that leave room for a natural conversation feel more welcoming, he adds. And finally, showy mocktails. A lot of the spirit-free cocktails on drink menus don't have the same sophistication as their alcohol-filled counterparts, says some critics. Just ask Jason Hall, a New York-based chef who doesn't drink alcohol. Mocktails come out in a Bordeaux glass with a big fruit garnish and a big straw, and you feel like you're getting this goofy thing, says Hall, who runs restaurants Sake no Hana and Cathedrale. It has way more pageantry than it needs. So, when dining out, he passes up attention, grabbing mocktails, and asks for simpler drinks such as tonic with non-alcoholic gin. The writer of this article was Alina Zizek. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Downsize Your Lawn, Start Here by Rebecca McMacken. It's hip to hate on lawns nowadays. Hashtags like Kill Your Lawn are all over social media. There's even a TV show with the same name. No wonder, with labor costs climbing and the harmful effects of lawn care chemicals on people and the planet becoming ever more obvious, the price of maintaining an emerald expanse starts to seem rather steep. Yet, we fret over the alternatives. In my 20-something years as a horticulturist, I've encountered all sorts of anxieties. Without a lawn, won't my land succumb to chaos? What about snakes and ticks and poison ivy? And the classic, what will the neighbors think? Which is why, despite my love of berries for birds and nectar for butterflies, I'm not a total turf abolitionist. Decades of working in public parks have taught me that lawns show people where they belong in a landscape. They give us a place to toss a ball or have a picnic. Aesthetically, lawns provide a visual break and help create flow through a space, connecting different areas. My real-world expert advice, rather than getting rid of our lawns, shrink them. Lawns should be area rugs, not wall-to-wall carpet. Use turf grass to mark the space you'll use for throwing frisbees and having parties, but allow the rest of your land to do something more beautiful and purposeful. Happily, fall's the perfect time to begin. Shrinking your lawn doesn't mean abandoning your proper to a jungle of vines and weeds. In fact, one timely technique uses a surprising gold mine almost all lawn owners have at their fingertips, leaves. Trees might look like they're throwing their leaves away in autumn, but they're actually carefully placing them over their root systems where they can break down and build healthy soil. A simple way to help A simple way to begin downsizing your lawns is by leaving a skirt of leaves unraked underneath your yard trees. Those leaves will smother the grass as they insulate the ground and hold in moisture. As they feed the soil, the same area can eventually be transitioned into low-maintenance garden beds. Plant them with low shrubs and perennial plants that are forest-adapted to grow among your leaves so that you and your blower can take a break. They're literally called leaves. You can leave them. In my Connecticut backyard, I've been reclaiming the turf under my maples and birches by planting native ferns, geraniums, and woodland asters. Not only is the result prettier than grass, the plants also support pollinators like moths and butterflies. Did you know that most caterpillars are only able to digest leaves from certain families of trees? Oaks support more than 1,000 species, while maples offer food to over 300, including swallowtails and mourning cloaks. If you love butterflies, you have to invite caterpillars into your garden too. Nearly every one of those caterpillars at some point drops from the tree canopy to overwinter or create a chrysalis. If you've ever glimpsed a caterpillar dangling from a branch by a silk thread, they're on their way down. But if they hit turf grass instead of leaves or other foliage at the bottom, their chance of survival is slim. Leaving plants and leaves under trees creates a soft landing for these essential creatures, whose populations have dropped an alarming 22% in just the last 20 years. Welcoming these beautiful beings onto your land will also attract songbirds, who rely on them to feed their babies. A few nibbled leaves are small prices to pay for the joy of birdsong and butterflies. Of course, downsizing your lawn yields another upsize, more time to enjoy them. A Hybrid 911, Still Seething, Now Smoother, More Refined, by Dan Neal. A few days before I left for Spain, I got a note from my friend David Scrivener, a producer for the television show Motor Week. Did I want to share a car on Porsche's 911 Turbo S test drive? Love to. I knew from past outings that Dave is not only an excellent company, a father of 12, funny as hell, but a superb driver. And on this trip, he put on a master class. With me in the right seat looking like Chewbacca in the asteroid field, Dave utterly thrashed the Porsche 911 Turbo S cabriolet as assigned to us, attacking the granite-toothed switchbacks of the Andalusian hill country like he hated them. We actually went faster and harder getting to the Circuito Ascari racetrack than we did once we were on it. I have pretty good car control. I can generally keep it together on a racetrack, but Dave, the senior driver for the public television car show Motor Week and pro-level road racer, is fearless. Death-defying, even. I might have preferred not to test the Turbo S's biggest ever carbon ceramic brakes while pointed over a cliff at 100 miles per hour. Dave reasons, when else would they matter? To the untrained eye on the Turbo S, the Turbo S might look like just another 911, one of dozens of variants with inscrutable nomenclature. GT2, Carrera 4S, Cabriolet, etc. But this, dear friends, is the big one, the quickest, most powerful, most versatile, most luxurious car in the 911 lineup. The legend, the proverbial gorilla in a tuxedo. And now it's a hybrid. Notwithstanding the 200 mile per hour top speed, the goal for the new Turbo S was cutting consumption and carbon emissions. While largely irrelevant to Porsche's buyers, these figures have a real bearing on profitability in major markets. According to Europe's WLTP test, the 2026 Turbo S is about 10% more fuel efficient. The mileage pencils out to about 20 miles per gallon, and all it took was a drastically redesigned propulsion system. The twin turbocharged 3.6-liter flat-six is new from the fuel injectors up. With no belt-driven accessories, this unit is a few inches more compact in the Z-axis. The turbos themselves are also smaller. These adjustments make just enough room on top of the engine for the pulse inverter and DC-to-DC converter. Which is to say, Porsche invented an entirely new flat-six, different bore diameters and everything, just to clear 11 centimeters under the engine cover. But it's not like the engineers had a choice. Nobody was going to tinker with the Turbo S's silhouette, were they? Likewise, the 8-speed PDK transmission is totally changed. Wrapped inside the transmission housing is an electric motor, 80 horsepower, 139 pound-feet, connected to the crankshaft via a dual-mass flywheel. To bear up under the higher stress, the PDK's clutches, gear sets, and bevel gear have all been reinforced. The integrated traction motor also serves as the starter. Press the start button to the left of the steering wheel, where it always been, and the Turbo S goes from silent to seething in an instant. The sexiest bits are the electrically powered turbochargers. These can add up to 38 horsepower of electric boost on their own, as well as recover energy from the engine braking. The turbos also allow precise modulation of intake pressures for improved combustion efficiency. And when you're done being efficient, light that candle. Unlike conventional turbos, the e-turbos spool to maximum almost instantly. The car's 590 pound-to-foot of electro-fortified torque is sustained from 2,300 to 6,000 revolutions per minute. The acceleration is terrifying. At full throttle, 6,500 to 7,000 RPM, the Turbo S is shaking a 701 horsepower fist at the sky. Come on, God, let's see what you've got. The e-turbos, therefore, make a significant contribution to the responsiveness, performance, and efficiency of the drive system. Porsche's press material deadpans, who says the Germans aren't funny? Purists may sniff that the hybrid Turbo S weighs 187 pounds more. Fair point. But it is also a staggering 14 seconds faster. Hell, the audio system probably weighs more than 187 pounds. Having seen how it was done, I took over from Dave. Within a couple of kilometers, I too was dive bombing mountain switchbacks and collapsing country roads into blurry wormholes. It was so alarmingly easy. In particular, the rear axle steering, standard equipment on the Turbo S, puts a huge tiller in the water, giving the Turbo S an easy thrust-building precision as the cornering loads build. If the AWD detects a sustained loss of traction at the rear, it can route up to 369 pound-foot to the front axle. Rough pavement or smooth uphill or down, off camber or on, trail braking into corners or powering out, golly, I thought either I'm going to getting better or the Turbo S's. It was the latter. Which brings us to the Turbo S's handling, cheat code, its active electro-hydraulic roll stabilization system. Powered by the same 400-volt system as the turbos and the e-motor, the roll-stabilizing EHPDCC tenses and relaxes the front and rear anti-rolls dynamically, very dynamically, in fact, instantaneously resisting roll and other chassis forces that might unstick the tires. From the driver's seat, the effect is a sort of enchanted road holding. No matter which way you pitch the car and across whatever wobbly surface, this powerful system is doing its level best to keep you level. By keeping the tires more squarely in contact with the road, the anti-roll system extracts higher thresholds of mechanical grip and lateral stability. Here is where the bespoke 32530 ZR21 rear tires have their say. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the November 1st, 2025 issue of Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal. We read from the Off Duty every Saturday at 6 p.m. Your reader has been Mary Beth. Thank you for listening.
Coming up next to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have Harper's Magazine. At 8 o'clock, we have Sports Illustrated. At 9 o'clock, we have The Athletic, a section of the New York Times. Stay with us for these readings and more through the rest of the evening. Thank you. following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision,